supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up a little later in the show, a revealing question about mums. Do you really have to keep pinching them back during the season to make them nice and full at the fall? What do they do in those giant production houses with tens of thousands of plants? They don't pinch them by hand, do they? We'll have the shocking, shocking revelation about mums after lots of your fabulous phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Gavin, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, I am in Nashville, Tennessee. I took some plants from the garden, jalapenos, macaroni pepper, kind of like a bell pepper, and a cayenne pepper called a dragon cayenne, and moved them in over the winter. Cut back the water. They did drop their leaves, but everything resprouted, started growing while it was inside over the winter. I planted them, and there's lots of buds, but there's just not a lot of leaf growth. And they kind of look a little puny as far as the color. But they seem to be fruiting, and I'm wondering if I did, when I winter them, if I did something wrong, or is there anything that I can do to give them kind of a kick in the pants?
Well, this is one of my absolute favorite topics, Gav. I love bringing my pepper plants out of the garden and inside to spend the winter under lights because I keep trying to tell people peppers are perennial. If they're protected from frost, they can live for 20, 30 years, and they grow into these magnificent little trees. Now, did you grow your peppers last year in pots or in the ground?
In the ground. I'm doing raised beds.
Yeah, but then you potted them up, right?
Yes, I potted them in very large containers, probably oversized, but give them enough room
right,
as not to try to strangle the roots.
What did you fill the containers with?
At that time, I was using just soil specifically for the garden.
When you moved them back outside again, did you take them out of their pots?
Yes, I sat them outside for a few days to kind of let them get acclimated. And then took them out of their pots and planted them directly into the raised beds again.
And over the winter, what kind of light did you give them?
Well, I have a 400-watt grow light, and this is another thing that I'm wondering about. I use the mercury halide bulb.
Oh, yeah, those big suckers. Yeah, those
it's a 400-watt bulb.
Yeah, I have a 400 and I have a 1,000. That's what I keep my plants under. On a big insulated porch.
My wife wouldn't go for 1,000. She said that 400 is about as much as I could do in it.
Those
in my office, so it's in a smaller room. So.
Those old incandescent high-powered lights are very expensive to run. She's right. If you can get by with a 4, it's a lot less expensive. Mm-hmm. Did you have them on a timer?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And did you feed them
about
at all?
I think it was, is it 10, 10, 10?
I mean, you're ruining the plan with chemical fertilizer. There is no plant on the planet that wants equal amounts of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. It's just to appeal to gardeners, no offense, who don't know what they're doing. So don't buy any more 10-10-10. You have access to worm castings. You can feed your pepper plants that. Now, when did you take them outside?
Normally, I plant around Easter. Our last frost is usually somewhere around that time, give or take.
Yeah. No, one of the worst things you can do is rush the season. I know everybody gets this garden horniness at the end of the winter, but it's not just frost. It's any nights that are really cold are going to damage pepper plants, tomato plants, cucumbers. You will get a better harvest earlier if you plant cowardly, if you wait until May.
Okay.
So you say they look okay. Now, you planted them back in the ground again. What I would suggest to you is as this season progresses, you get yourself some nice individual planters for your peppers. Get a good soil-free mix, a potting soil and some compost. Mix that up. And then when you take your plants out of the ground this fall, put them into those pots, bring them inside, mm-hmm. and then keep them in their pots. They can stay in those pots when they go back out again. And then mm-hmm. if you're suddenly getting ready to go to bed and you catch on TV, it's going to be 39 that night, you can run outside and save them easily. And there won't mm-hmm. be that transplant shock all the time. At this point, the fact that you have little flowers and little buds that haven't fallen off, that's golden. Mm-hmm. The leaves will come. I want you to either mulch them with an inch of good, high-quality compost or get a bag mm-hmm. of worm castings and mix that into the top inch of the soil, or go to mm-hmm. a good garden center and get a liquid organic plant food that's like a mixture of fish and seaweed. Pepper plants okay. love that stuff. So you'll do fine. Keep them in their pots from now on after you do the next transition, and you either misspoke or somebody gave you a bad label, because you are growing one of my favorite sweet peppers called Marconi, named after the inventor.
Oh, I did not know that.
Without Marconi, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be on the air. You could look it up.
No, we wouldn't.
All right, Gav, I think you're doing 90% great, and we're going to take you over the top with the last 10.
Okay, I'll keep you updated. I'll send you an email and let you know how things are going.
Yeah, send us some pictures of some beautiful ripe peppers. Those Marconis are beautiful plants.
Yes, they are.
All right, Gav, good
Thank
luck.
Thank you very much for your time. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Mary, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Mary. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I am just ducky, thank you. Where is Mary well?
I'm in Cape May, New Jersey.
Oh, okay. What part of Cape May? Are you in the painted lady section?
No, I'm more in the rural section out by the canal where there are farms still and vineyards.
What can we do for Mary in a different part of Cape May?
Well, I'm just 3 miles from the town of Cape May, and I'm a beekeeper, mm-hmm. and we have the scourge of mosquitoes all summer. Mm-hmm. They're staying now, in fact. And even when I'm completely covered and I'm out in the yard, they're biting my face. And someone told me to use dunks. And I'm worried that the dunks are not safe for the bees. And I also have a small pond that has a leopard frog or two in
oh,
it.
Oh, great.
Can I put a dunk in the pond? And can I put it anywhere around? Will it hurt the bees at all?
Absolutely yes and absolutely not. What is
right.
what is in these dunks? And yeah, I know you're talking about the little donuts that you see for sale yeah. at every home center. Well, this material also comes in the shape of a briquette like you would use on a charcoal grill. And it also comes in granular form. But the yeah. active ingredient is the same no matter what. It's BTI. A strain of Bacillus thuringiensis named for Israel, really. It's Israeliensis because it was discovered on soils in a beach in Israel. All of the BTs are very specific. The first BT that was understood, developed, is BTK, which farmers know as Dipel. If you spray BTK on a plant typically attacked by caterpillars, any caterpillar that eats the sprayed leaves will die, but birds can land on those leaves. Birds can eat the caterpillars that fed on the sprayed leaves. Frogs can eat the caterpillars that fed on the sprayed leaves. So the mm-hmm. same is true with BTI. You throw it in a pond, or in your case, you deliberately put out buckets of water laced with BTI, encouraging, giving the mosquitoes an easy place to lay their eggs. They lay their eggs in the treated water, and then nothing happens. The eggs can't develop into the biting adult stage. But a frog or toad can jump into that bucket and swim around in it for a couple of days and not be harmed. Your bees, if there's a perching area for them to get at the water, because you know it's very difficult for bees to drink. They need really tiny water sources. But let's mm-hmm. say a bee could get to the water, it would not affect them. BTI only does one thing, and that's prevent biting members of the fly family from breeding in treated water. And mosquitoes mm-hmm. are a member of the fly family. And this is confirmed by Dr. Dina Fonseca at Rutgers University, who is one of the nation's leading authorities on intelligent mosquito control. And just a few weeks ago, in the show we aired that had the big interview on permaculture, we got a phone call because there was a beekeeper spreading rumors about BTI being toxic. We got another researcher to confirm that it was not, and she went into amazing detail about how their guts are different, how the pH is different, and explaining in great detail how it would be impossible for BTI to have a negative effect on bees. So you can control your mosquitoes, and it will have no effect, positive or negative, on your bees. Or your frogs, or your birds, or anything other than biting insects.
I'm so relieved. Thank you. That should make summer much more pleasant.
Excellent. Good for you, Mayor. Take care.
You too, Mike. Bye-bye.
It's time for our host to take a short break and for me to announce that Mike will give you his best mid-season garden advice at noon and 2 on Sunday, June 26th at the Burlington County Earth Fair at historic Smithville Park in Mount Holly, New Jersey. But don't go looking for all the details of the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with some almost unbelievable info about mums and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Alexis Landis, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, do you really have to pinch your mum's back several times a season to make them nice and full? What do growers who have tens of thousands of plants in greenhouses do? They can't be pinching them all by hand, can they? We'll reveal the revealing, revelatory answer after more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Caleb, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, sir. Where are you, Kay?
I am in Princeton, New Jersey.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Caleb in the Garden State?
Well, I have a hypothesis that indoor potted plants prefer more frequent wet, dry cycles. I was just wondering what you thought about that.
Now, when you say more frequent wet, dry cycles, are you talking about they would prefer to be watered more deeply, less frequently?
No, less deeply, more frequently.
No, just the opposite. Just the opposite. Oh. And the same is true for all plants. One of the things that a lot of gardeners don't realize is plants are just as lazy as we are. They're not going to work any harder than they have to. Mm-hmm. So whether it's a house plant, a tomato plant, or a lawn, if that area right around the root zone is constantly saturated, is there any incentive for the roots to grow longer?
No.
They're just in there. I mean, there is a risk of them starting to get oversaturated and rotten.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say we totally saturate one of your house plants. We take it to the sink, fill the sink with a couple inches of water, let it sit there for a couple of hours. Then we sit it in the drain board, pick it up. Now it feels incredibly heavy compared to when it went in. And we just leave it alone for a week. And let's say this is a warm week. It's summertime now. There's sun coming in. The plant is actively growing.
Sure. Uh-huh.
So some sources would tell you the next day to feel the surface of the soil and water if the surface feels dry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course the surface of the soil is going to dry. It probably dried out in about, 3 hours. But get a little dowel or a pencil or something that's going to show the water line and stick it into the soil off to the side, and you'll see that that water line is probably a quarter of an inch down from the top. So the roots are still totally saturated. 2 days later, maybe the water line is 2 inches down. The roots are still totally saturated in water. Now, after about 5 or 6 days, maybe it's just in the very bottom of the pot, and we've passed the main root system, which is now in dry soil. So is the plant going to, get X's on its eyes and keel over? No. It's going to send down root hairs. It's going to send down these advanced scouts of the wagon train looking for where the water went. So they'll go down deeper. And then when there's no water left in the pot and you can rock it very easily without any resistance, you can tell that it's back to being super lightweight again.
Yeah.
You repeat that process, but now you have already developed a healthier, thicker, stronger root system. We follow this process for the whole summertime. Then at the end of the summer, you have now got a houseplant that can go twice as long without watering if you are not around, because it has twice as much of an underground storage system. It has these big roots that are essentially water tanks.
Okay.
Then when you get to the winter time, then you just cut back, period. Because people don't really think about it, but in the wintertime, our house plants are mostly dormant. The big exception is indoor citrus. That really grows wildly during the winter because that's its normal season where it comes from. But most of the house plants we have sitting around are going very slow, very dormant. They're getting many fewer hours of daylight. The light that they're getting is coming from a different angle that doesn't really trigger photosynthesis. So they're not using a lot of water. In the wintertime, under conditions of normal humidity, houseplants should be watered less than half as often as during the summer when they're actively growing.
Okay. Well, I just started developing this hypothesis over the winter, so that might explain why I have this question.
We think that the plants need us more than they do. We actually need them more than they need us. The ideal situation for any plant, whether it's a house plant, a garden plant, or a lawn, is long, deep, but infrequent soakings. Good soaking, good saturation, but then allowing the roots to dry out, just like your feet. You wouldn't want them to be wet all the time. You need them to dry out between waterings.
Okay, fantastic.
All right, great question. Thanks. Educated a lot of gardeners today, man.
All right, thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Marcy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how you doing? All's well over here in Philadelphia.
Well, I mean, I'm in Philadelphia right now myself, Marce. What part of the city are you in?
I'm in Roxborough.
Well, is Roxborough technically Philadelphia?
Yes, it is, actually.
Is your zip code 191?
Yes, it is.
Okay, well, you get by. I always thought you were on the wrong side of the Schuylkill, but that's...
No, we're on the good side.
Yeah, sure. That's what everybody says. All right, what can we do for Marcy and Roxborough?
I've been gardening in my backyard for the last 5 years. I'm an amateur, as I would still say I am. But we started out with just one little small round hole in the ground. Now we've got about, I think we're at 50 feet long by about maybe 10 feet wide.
Right.
And just little by little, we've been chipping away at the grass because it was a huge lawn.
Right.
And I just want to know, what is the best way to get rid of that grass? We have a running...
You'll never get rid of it, Morse.
Okay.
No. And you have a flat earth garden.
Yes.
See, this is why people build raised beds.
Right.
The biggest enemy... I mean, I always get a kick out of people who can't grow a decent-looking lawn. Because we gardeners grow great lawns, right?
We sure do.
In the middle of our peppers and tomatoes and cucumbers and lettuce. If you have a running grass, a grass with rhizomes that goes laterally, you will spend every minute of your gardening life fighting it. But that's one of the big benefits of raised beds.
Right.
So I'll tell you what, you can do what you want with your little truck patch. What I want you to do is take an area that gets good sun that's near the garden.
Yes.
I want you to get your lawnmower, and I want you to scalp that area. I want you to cut it so low you see dirt blowing out the back of the mower.
Okay.
Then I want you to lay cardboard down over top of that scalped area. And then on top of that, you're going to build a raised bed that's no wider than 4 feet.
Okay.
You can build it out of bricks, pavers. You can build it out of Trex landscape timbers. You can build it out of cheap pine landscape timbers. Don't use pressure-treated wood or anything toxic. But just frame it out with whatever you got and then fill it with a mixture of compost and topsoil and perlite from a local garden center. Perlite is that little white rock-like stuff.
Right, yeah.
It's a mined volcanic mineral. It's a great soil lightener. So fill this raised bed up with compost, topsoil, and as much perlite as you're willing to buy, and then put your new set of plants into there, and 2-3 months from now, you are going to have to go see the doctor. Because you have slapped your forehead so many times going, why did it take me so long to figure this out? Because the best thing about grass is it will always, the type of grass you have, which is probably bluegrass.
Right.
It will always spread laterally to fill in its own bare spots, but it has not yet learned to make little siege towers to go up a foot high barrier. And I want you to make sure this box is no wider than 4 feet because you're never going to step into it. And then you'll never have to till it up because if you must be tilling up your truck patch, right?
Yes, I am.
And then the weeds are amazing, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Tilling causes weeds. It releases soil nutrients. It exposes buried weed seeds to the sunlight, which is the trigger for germination. And then what do? You replant those weed seeds, right?
Sure, probably
and then,
am. That's what I'm doing.
Level it out real nice. You feed and water them. I bet you got a good crop of weeds.
Oh, yes, I do.
So
looking at them all the time.
So you scalp the areas. You lay the cardboard down to make that initial barrier to smother any rhizomes that are under there. And you are going to be so happy with just one raised bed that you will then take your truck patch and you'll break it up into the typical size is 4x8 raised beds with 2 feet of walking lanes in between. And you can let the grass grow in the walking lanes and just weed whack it.
Sure.
But you will be done fighting grass. You'll be done fighting weeds. your garden, the soil will warm up faster in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
It'll dry out faster after a heavy rain. It won't get flooded out like it does every couple of years when you get a heavy rain.
Sure.
So raised beds beat flat earth anytime, but especially if you're if you're growing near a lawn.
Okay.
All right, Mars?
That'll be great. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. You have a good season.
All right, you too. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Mike, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello. Love your show.
Hey, thank you very much, Mike. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Oklahoma City.
Oh, I was just there. Southern hospitality exists in Oklahoma City. I can vouch for that.
Yes, it's a good town.
All right. What can we do for Mike in OK?
I am a superintendent at a large office complex, and we just had a really large replanting of all of our beds, and everything seems to be taking really well except for our sweet potato vines. Something is eating holes in them. I've inspected the plants a couple of times, and I have not been able to find a single mite or bug or anything on them, and I was just wanting to find something kind of non-plastic that we could put on those particular plants.
Now, are we talking about sweet potatoes for eating, or are we talking about these ornamental sweet potatoes?
No, the ornamentals. The ornamentals.
They're really variegated ones. And you've got those trailing on the ground and not hanging from pots?
Correct.
Oh, okay. And what kind of an area are they in?
Most of them are on a north side, in kind of a burned, large bed area with other ground cover and color and all sorts of stuff.
And you do not have entire leaves missing. You have little holes chewed out of the leaves.
I bunch. I'm afraid we might lose them.
Well, you'd be surprised. One thing, did you do the planting or anything?
No, we had a company come in and do it all.
One of the most interesting things about these ornamental sweet potato vines is that there is a bizarrely colored and shaped sweet potato underneath the soil that's pumping out those vines and those leaves. So if you had voles or something go underground and eat the actual sweet potato tuber, that would be the end of the plants. But as long as you've just had some leaf damage, that underground tuber has a lot of energy in it, and it can restore the leaves. So my first thought, when you got plants like this hugging the ground that are keeping the ground moist, is slugs or snails. Not a normal pest, I would think, in dry Oklahoma, but you guys have had a lot of water, right?
Yes, it's raining right now. And that would be at night mostly also. Maybe that's why I haven't seen anything.
Exactly. Exactly right. So much damage that is done by slugs in the middle of the night gets blamed on some innocent bug who just flying around the garden in the day, because that's when we're out there looking. So there's two things you can do to test for the presence of slugs. If it's raining really heavily, I want you to just take a couple of long wooden boards and lay them down in the general area where the plants are being eaten. And then tomorrow morning, after the sun comes up, hopefully, go out there with like a 5-gallon bucket with a little bit of soapy water in the bottom and a ruler. Lift up the boards, and if I'm right, the underside of the board is going to be covered with slugs who are hiding from the heat of the day, especially in Oklahoma. Or conversely, if you want to come back to work at 2 o'clock in the morning and go crawling around out there on your hands and knees with a flashlight taped to your head. You
know. Not necessarily, no.
I kind of like the image, Mike. If it were dry, I would tell you to come back in the evening or last thing you do before you leave work, but as late in the day as possible. Pop a couple of cans of cheap beer and fill traps like half pint or pint size containers from the deli and leave those around near the plants. Slugs are tremendously attracted by the yeasty smell of the beer. They crawl in and they're overcome by the alcohol. So in the morning, you find the tubs filled with dead, drunken slugs.
That's hilarious. And I'm gonna try that just to see that.
Exactly. But you don't want to keep buying beer for your slugs. So what you do once you've confirmed that they are the problem is, if you can, you raise the vines up a little bit off the ground, get some airflow around there. But there is a relatively new, I'm talking new as in like 10 years old, slug bait. It used to be slug baits were tremendously toxic. They were one of the worst pesticides out there. But the newer generation are iron phosphate bound inside a yeasty bait. So the slugs come to feed on these little pellets to get the yeast, and then they ingest the iron, and they can't metabolize it, and they die. And you'll find these for sale in garden centers under names like Sluggo, and my favorite, Escargo. Escar-Go. But they're very safe for people and wildlife and the environment, but they're toxic to slugs. And I think that's
well,
what
great.
You got.
All right. You've been a great help. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
It's time for our host to take another short break and for me to remind you that Mike will deliver his best mid-season garden advice at noon and 2 on Sunday, June 26th at the Burlington County Earth Fair at historic Smithville Park in Mount Holly, New Jersey. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with some almost unbelievable info about mums and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Alexis Landis, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens, in just a few short minutes, as opposed to those agonizing long minutes, we'll get to the question of the week and reveal how professionals get that fully flowered look on those fall mums at the end of the season. Do they sit around pinching them with their thumb and forefinger like gardeners do? We'll tell you the truth about mum production after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Ron, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. How are you today?
Hey, very good. Ron, how are you doing, sir?
Just great, thank you.
And where is Ron great?
Villisca, Iowa.
Well, of course, I immediately know what part of Iowa that's in, Ron.
Southwest.
Southwest Iowa. Kind of a short growing season up there, huh, man?
Yeah, unless you're growing corn or beans, I guess it works pretty good.
You know, it's amazing with the short season, you guys, how known you are for corn production.
Yeah, there's a lot of it. And nobody irrigates. It's all done naturally. Nobody irrigates corn in the state of Iowa.
You don't have to. The snow is still melting in July. All right, what can we do for Ron in Iowa?
I love figs, fig preserves. I want to grow my own figs. And everything that I've found, the research, some say you can do it, but you got to bring them in during the winter. Others say you can warm house them, wrap them in burlap or something, but nobody can give me a straight answer on which type of fig grows best in Iowa.
Well, one of the reasons you're seeing conflicting information is a lot of garden writers, a lot of experts don't really think about the different parts of the country. If you're growing figs in North Carolina, you don't have to do nothing but eat the figs. Same thing in Oklahoma, Texas, a place like that. Anytime you've got a climate where you've got a nice warm growing season and a relatively gentle winter, you don't have to do anything. Figs just love growing. As you move further north, get into the Philadelphia area and then north of there up in New York State, the figs do great in the summer, but they're going to suffer in the winter. So some people will wrap them up. They'll drive stakes into the ground around the tree, wrap burlap around the stakes, and then maybe throw some row cover on the top just to protect the tree from the worst of the winter winds. Up in Iowa, your figs would die down to the roots. They would not sprout back up again in the spring. In New York State, let's say, a fig that suffers winter damage might look dead. It'll resprout from the roots, but not where you are. It just gets too cold. So your best choice is to get a really big pot and to look around at local sources, at mail order sources or local nurseries that really specialize in the far north, and get the hardiest fig you can. Now, you have to be careful because, quote, hardy fig is kind of a generic term. And the fig varieties, they've kind of gotten mixed up over the years. But the important thing is you would get a nice big pot. And do you have a place that you can bring this thing inside for the winter? It doesn't have to stand up like a house plant, but it would need to be indoors.
Oh, sure. Plenty of room.
Now, here's what you would do. Like right now, you would go out and you'd get your baby fig tree. You'd get a nice container, maybe something that's already on wheels or that you can easily put on casters or something like that. And you fill the container with half potting soil, half compost. You put your fig in it, and it's going to grow a lot of beautiful greenery this year. If winter comes on late, you may even get a few figs the first year. But mostly this first year, you're going to be growing it to get it up to size. Then before it gets really cold at all, you bring the thing inside, preferably to a cool area, like a cellar that maybe stays at around 40, 50 degrees, something like that. And you can leave it standing up. You can turn it on its side. You water it once or twice over the winter. That's all. You're not trying to grow it. You're just keeping it alive. And then after all the snow is melted and the last chance of frost is done, you move it back outside into the sun. And then with a good pair of pruners, you give it a light cutting. If anything died while it was inside, you cut that off. But otherwise, you give it like a gentle haircut all around just to stimulate new growth. And if you do it right, and you got a lot of wiggle room in here, you should get figs that second year. You should get them right around the end of August, beginning of September.
Wonderful. And you're supposed to get two crops a year, correct?
Yeah, you're supposed to get two crops a year if Ron moves down to Waco. That's where you're going to get two crops.
Okay.
Yeah. So you have a good chance to get a nice crop of figs every year. If you've never grown the plants themselves, you're going to be delighted at how beautiful and ornamental they are. They're fabulous looking plants with great structures. And you take really good care of them, you get one crop a year. You want to move down to the Carolinas, you can shoot for two.
I'll stick where I'm at.
All right, Ron, good luck to you, sir.
I'm excited. Thank you very much.
All right, good luck, man.
All right, thanks a lot.
1-888-346-9499. Avo, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, sir. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you so much for making it. How are you doing today?
Doing great.
Where is Avo doing great?
Broomall, Pennsylvania, Delaware County.
Okay. What can we do for you?
I have three peach trees, and three of them are in the grassy area, and I have the fourth one in the raised garden area. And three of them, which are in the grassy area, their leaves are crumbling. It looks like it has a virus in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's reddish. It looks like scabs all over the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
But the one in my raised bed is perfectly fine.
Okay.
So I don't know what's going on.
Okay. So how long have you had these peach trees?
The ones in the grassy area, it's been about 3 years, 3-4 years.
Mm-hmm.
The one in the raised bed is still, it's the same, about 2 years.
Okay. And do you treat the grassy area? Is this a lawn? Do you have the lawn treated, fed, herbicide?
I did it once about 2 years ago, and ever since now I haven't done it because the trees are giving fruit, and it's really delicious, but no, I haven't done it for 3 years now.
Okay. It sounds like you have peach leaf curl, and the grass is growing right up to the trunks of the trees?
Yes.
Okay, so that's stressing them. What needs to be done is you need to get there with a hoe or gloved hands, and you need to pull that grass back, and you need to make a good circle of a foot of bare ground around the base of the peach tree. And then have you ever mulched the tree or fed it?
No.
Okay, good.
I haven't done anything to it.
Good, because I want you to remove the grass from the three trees that have the grass encroaching all around them. Remove the grass and replace it with an inch of yard waste compost, real compost that you know, like made in your municipality or at a garden center, not composted manure.
Okay.
Now, do you prune the trees?
I did it last year. I didn't do it this year yet.
Well, I mean, it's kind of late. You're supposed to prune them in late winter or right around when they're flowering.
Okay.
And peach trees need to be pruned every year. So it's not too late because you got to get in there and improve the airflow. This is because they're crowded. You need to get in there and remove any branches that are going straight up and branches that are crossing each other. I want you to go to our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
Yes.
Go to Garden Answers A to Z and go to the letter F for fruit trees, and it'll give you a little lesson on fruit tree care and pruning. But peach trees need to be opened up quite a bit. You need to remove about a third of the branches, especially in the areas where there's no airflow, where everything is all crowded.
Okay.
Now, in the three trees that are affected with the curl, is it on every branch or just some of them?
The lower leaves are crumbling. The upper leaves, the ones in the, no, we'll say about maybe 6 feet up above that, they're not crumbling.
Okay, good. So the first thing you want to do when you prune them is remove the entire branch of any areas that have this disease on them, and then get those branches out of there. Throw them in the trash. Don't leave them anywhere near the tree.
Okay.
And then do you thin the fruits?
Okay.
What I mean, with peaches, you're supposed to pull off half to three quarters of the little fruits when they're small so that you get good quality full-sized ones.
Okay.
You see, peach trees are a lot of work. They're not an easy care plant. They need to be pruned. The fruits need to be thinned. The bottoms need to be kept clean with a layer of compost. But then if you do that, if you open up the tree, you do a good pruning, you take off some of the baby peaches, you get rid of everything that looks bad on the trees right now, it's still early enough in the season that you could have good quality fruit, and the trees might look good for the rest of the season as well. But get rid of all the prunings of any that have the curly leaves on them.
Well, the leaves that have good leaves, can we eat those fruits?
Even peaches that show up on diseased parts of the tree are safe to eat. Even a peach with a little disease on it is safe to eat. You just always want to cut off the disease part because it's nasty.
Okay. Beautiful. Thank you so much.
All right, man. Good luck.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week, which we're calling Modern Mums Should Not Need Much Pinching. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started by pinching this week's question.
Sure, Mike. Linda in Pennington, New Jersey writes, I have lots of chrysanthemums. My mother taught me to pinch off the top leaves as they grow to force the plants to get bushy rather than spindly. But I have so many plants, and it is arduous work for my tired old hands. Can I just cut them off with shears or hedge clippers? I'm guessing that mum growers don't do this by hand.
Well, that would have been my guess as well, but it turns out that the opposite is true. All of the pinching performed in commercial mum production is done by human hands. The university articles I read all emphasize that it's the biggest expense in mum production. And one extra pinching a season can mean the difference between profit and loss to a grower.
How many times does one of the typical plants we buy at a garden center in the fall get pinched over the course of a season?
These days, they can get by with just one, says Mark Haynes of Del Valle Flora in Sewell, New Jersey. They provide a lot of the plants for the Philadelphia Flower Show, as well as to area nurseries and garden centers. But he adds that older varieties used to have to be pinched back 3 or 4 times during the growing season, which was hugely expensive for the producers.
So what happened?
Breeders develop varieties that are what Mark calls pretty much self-branching, which means they're naturally inclined to grow those almost impossibly tight flower clusters that make these plants really pop at garden centers in the fall, a trait that previously had to be accomplished by all that repeated hand labor.
Okay, but even these new kinds of mums still get pinched back at least once, right?
Oh, yeah. And at Del Valle, that happens in June, which is pretty much the optimum time almost anywhere. If they are so inclined, home growers can pinch their mums back several times during the season. But everyone has to stop before the flower buds begin to form.
When is that?
Well, it's tricky because they're not there. You know, there's no visual cue. Although another way to say this is that if you see anything that looks like flower buds, it's too late to pinch. In the book Perennials for Every Purpose, noted garden writer Larry Hodgson gives rough cutoff dates of July 15th in the north, August 1st in the middle latitudes, and August 15th in the deep south. But Mark at Del Valle, who does grow specifically for and in the north, strongly suggests a more conservative approach. Finish all your pinching by early July to make sure you don't remove any of those flower buds.
Because it sounds like mums can easily regrow their greenery, but only put out one set of flower buds a season. Now, what exactly does pinching mean?
You reach down each stem to what Mark calls the first truly mature leaf, which should be an inch or two from the top of the plant, and you literally just pinch it off the same way you'd pinch a mischievous child, or be pinched by a mischievous child. Squeeze it between your thumb and forefinger. Every stem you pinch back will branch out into 2 stems, theoretically doubling the number of possible flowers. And shearing or cutting won't do the same thing. You have to pinch it all out.
But that doesn't help our listener.
Well, first, she doesn't need to pinch her mums. They're going to bloom just fine without any help. She does call her plants spindly, but that can be caused by lack of sun. Like lots of other plants, mums get leggy if you throw a lot of shade at them. Mums will also stay naturally more tight and compact if the plants are dug up and divided every 3 or 4 years in the spring. There are also lots of different kinds of mums, including varieties that are known as florist's mums, bred to flower on top of long stems for cunning. So if some of her mums are especially leggy, she might want to cut them with lots of stem attached and display them inside in a vase. Mums are one of the longest lasting of all cut flowers.
I like that idea.
And maybe she can do a single pinching in mid to late June, especially of the plants that are closest to the house or her favorite varieties. But just a few plants at a time over the course of several weeks. And in the morning, before the sun hits the area you're going to be working in, which is my favorite time of day to be in the garden, she can loosen up those tired old hands with a warm water soak before she goes out, and then do that pinching while you're sitting on a stool so you're not stressing your back.
It is so nice to putter around in the garden before the heat really starts to build.
Right. Make it nice. Spread out the work over a few weeks. Time it all for the cool of the early morning. Warm up your hands before you go out. Do the work sitting down. And you'll turn what used to look like an onerous chore into a very pleasant garden experience. Well, those sure were some good ideas about pinching your mums without pooping yourself out. Now, wasn't they? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to pinch my peppers if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email with your location. You're tired, you're poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore. With your location at garden@whyy.org. Oh, and please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares where you are, but where you will find the answers to all of those garden questions you were going to email us, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. We bid a fond farewell to our all-too-ephemeral intern, Mary Rose, and officially welcome aboard Emma Bixler. Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar keep our website well-pinched. Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, was previously pinched for picking purloined peaches in Poughkeepsie. We have to pinch our editor, Al Banks, several times a season. I'm leggy Mike McGrath, because I'll pinch no plant before it's time, and I'll see you again next week. You say cantaloupe, I say muskmelon. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the misnaming of tropical melons and what it takes to grow those tasty treats of summer, plus the plant science in your backyard and your fabulous phone calls.